From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we meet David Wagner. His Milwaukee-based art exhibition company has placed shows around the country, including one currently on view in Green Bay.
Then the creator of that exhibit explains why he and his partner decided to take their children along for their expeditions to the Arctic.
Part of the motivation for that was actually the opportunity to take our kids out there with us so they can experience these incredible travels and these parts of our planet.
Dining critic Ann Christensen seizes the day with a meal outdoors.
My theory about why outdoor dining has really gotten even better here in terms of where you can sit on rooftops with these incredible gardens is that we have such a short amount of time to really enjoy it.
And why the Wisconsin State Park System welcomes an annual Shakespearean production. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Most art curators work for museums. They tend to have substantial academic credentials in art history and museum studies. David Wagner is not an art historian, and his academic background is in musical performance and arts administration. But he is a curator.
Wagner's Milwaukee-based business, David J. Wagner, LLC, arranges and markets art exhibitions for museums around the world. At any one time, he might have 8 to 10 different exhibitions on the road. We'll hear more about one of them currently on view in Green Bay a little later in the show. But now we were curious to learn more about this facet of the art business, so we asked David Wagner to come to the show. Thanks so much, David, for coming in.
My pleasure.
How did you get into the curatorial business as a private entity? I mean, you're not affiliated with museums, but yet you have all of these wonderful exhibits going around the world. So how did that happen for you? I mean, you started out as a musician, right?
I did. However, my career was sideswiped. When I was in graduate school, I took an elective class. It was taught by the director of the museum at Indiana University in Bloomington, where I was doing my master's degree, and I had been accepted in applied piano in the music school, which is a good music school. But along the way, I changed the course of my career and morphed into a program entitled Arts Administration. It was a young program back then, and its concept was to train people to be in the management side of the arts business. So to fulfill that degree, I signed up for an elective of museum studies. And the instructor, a professor, took me under his wing. He liked my work, and he asked me if I'd like to do an internship at his museum, the Indiana University Museum.
Had you had any experience with the visual arts before that, other than just going to a museum yourself and looking at them?
Not really. I was reared in the performing arts. I have a degree in applied piano. I play the guitar. I have a degree in a minor in vocal performance. But I really didn't have a background in museums, though I had visited them. In fact, as a kid, would come with my cousins and grandmother and mother to the Milwaukee Public Museum when it was in another entire building. So I have a long relationship with museums, but really I hadn't envisioned a career in museums whatsoever back then.
So what was it about the idea of curating a visual experience for people that grabbed you?
I like working with artists. I like working with paintings and sculptures, getting to develop a concept into the reality, the physical reality of an exhibition. And throughout the early portion of my career, I was given an opportunity to take exhibitions that I was involved with to develop and to travel them around the country and around the world for that matter. The first exhibition that I had the opportunity to tour went to the Smithsonian, which was a grand slam in anyone's career. But back then I was probably 26 or 27 years old. And I was just very lucky, very fortunate to have the connections and the wherewithal to take an exhibition as my first exhibition to the Smithsonian.
I was going to say sort of the mecca of museums.
Yeah, I've never topped that.
Well, what a wonderful experience to have. Do you find that your musical background and your performing background helps you visualize, maybe that's the wrong verb to use, but it helps you conceptualize these more static exhibits.
I suppose in the sense that you get great organizational skills and discipline in the performing arts. You must have those to be a reasonably good musician. However, for many years, I used to think about the correlation in art history and music history of the various isms and movements and periods of art, classical art, Baroque, Impressionism, so forth. And they really never correlated as much as I thought they would. So in a direct sense, the answer is probably no.
I was thinking of it even more conceptually, even more in sort of in a meta way of like, as a musician, do you think about how you're going to lay things out and how people would experience it differently?
I think about elements and principles of composition and design, for sure. When I'm involved in curating an exhibition, I have sort of an equation. And the top side of my equation is quality. Number one for me is quality, 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 because my company is attempting to market and promote exhibitions to museums. And museums are filled with people who are trained with connoisseurship studies, and they really have an eye for quality. That's their business, after all. So I have to offer them artworks that have quality. On the other hand, the underside of the equation is diversity. If I am organizing an exhibition of animals in art, well, I don't want all alligators or giraffes in the exhibition. I want a diverse environmental spectrum of all classes and all species of animals. So there's diversity, but then there has to be quality as an overarching sort of parameter.
When you were setting up the business, which is a private company, as you say, marketing to museums who often have curatorial staffs of their own who are trying to set up their own things, how do you work in that? How does that cooperation or lack thereof work? Has it been difficult for you to convince museums to get something from outside?
I would say that most museums look at traveling or changing exhibitions as a hook, as something new to bring people into the door or back into the door. Most museums become fairly static if they just simply rely on their permanent collections, unless they're a destination museum with a historic importance or something like that. Williamsburg, everyone's going to Williamsburg because it's an experience, of colonial America. On the other hand, if you take more of a public or a community museum, they may have a great collection, but there's always something that the people in marketing department at the museum want to bring new people or return visitors back in. And that's a given in museums. Museums have developed that sort of paradigm. So there's a ready-made market for exhibitions.
So you have a niche to fill.
I do, and I have competition, too. Museums and organizations like mine, our organization is very, very small. It's a small company. It's an LLC that we incorporated in the state of Wisconsin right here in Milwaukee. But the Smithsonian, for example, has an entire department right on the mall that's dedicated to producing and traveling exhibitions. That's one of the biggest entities of that sort. And then there are many, many others throughout the nation. But really, there aren't that many. So it is a niche market, as you say.
Well, and you can make a living doing this.
Yeah. It's a challenge. After I came out of graduate school, I was very fortunate to be offered a job as a museum director. And I think I was about 23 or 24 years old when I was given that job. It was a small museum. But in any event, I had that job for 10 years and then moved on to several other jobs. So I was a museum director for 20 years, and I had made all sorts of contacts, and I learned the ropes, learned the business. And one day a friend of mine, I was working in New York, I was employed there at a museum, and a friend of mine who was the chair of graduate studies at Bard Graduate School, he said to me, Dave, have you ever thought about going private? And, I never really have. And the light bulb kind of went off in my mind. It was like being an artist, but having your day job as an art instructor, you're jumping off a cliff. You're leaving that comfort and that safety net of having health insurance and a regular paycheck. But I tried it. I jumped off the cliff. I formed this LLC. I had all sorts of contacts from 20 years of experience. And the one thing that I really liked about doing this was I get to work with exhibitions. as a museum professional, a director of 20 years, you sort of grow out of the core activity of doing exhibitions. I mean, you're involved with working with fundraising, public relations, board members, the politics of it all, and all those other things, management, in other words. So this was a thought that he had given me that enabled me to get back to the basics and do what I really liked to do in the first place, and that was curate exhibitions.
Well, and you've got a number of them out right now. You gave me a list, basically a number of pamphlets here. The reason I found out about you was because of an exhibition that's currently in Green Bay. We interviewed the artist.
Corey Trepanier.
Right. And that's how I found out about you and about your company and the fact that he's represented, or at least this exhibition is yours. And so it looks like, despite the fact that you are a small LLC, you've got a lot going on.
We do. We probably have about a half a dozen to 8 or 10 exhibitions somewhere in the nation and hopefully beyond. Corey's exhibition, Into the Arctic, is a Canadian project. We work closely with the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C. to launch it. It's at the Neville Public Museum for the summer in Green Bay. And as a matter of fact, Corey was giving a talk at a film screening. He's a filmmaker, an explorer, and an artist, a painter. And he was screening a film in Monaco at an environmental program. And unbeknownst to us, the Prince of Monaco stood up before the crowd and announced that he was going to have the museum there host our exhibition in the summer of 19, the entire summer, in Monaco. And I thought, wow, is that amazing? We haven't even pitched it, and we've just heard that it's been announced that it's coming to Monaco. So
you've become international beyond Canada.
Yeah. Well, in that sense, I mean, that was a real surprise, and we're, you know, delighted. I've worked on other international projects. But this one is the most recent to really take off in a big, big, big way.
What are some of the challenges that you find doing this work? Is it finding places to take the exhibitions, or is it finding the things to make up the exhibitions themselves?
Well, the number one challenge is marketing. It's all about sell, sell, sell. You have to have a good quality product, a good diverse product, but you also then have to get it out there in the marketplace. It's like if you're a writer on the staff of a newspaper, space in a newspaper is precious. So the publisher and the editor-in-chief, they weigh carefully how much space you're given as a writer. The same with exhibitions. Museums only have 12 months in a year, and they have a lot to choose from, and they have a lot of their own ideas, their own concepts, things they want to develop. So somehow you have to find your way, wiggle your way into that scenario, and first of all, offer something that interests the museum, and then you have to get them to sign the dotted line in a contract and take the exhibition. So that's not an easy challenge. In fact, that's the greatest challenge I face and my company faces. But we've been fortunate. I mean, I've been blessed since the LLC was founded in the late 90s to have regular exhibitions, some of them ongoing continuously from place to place, down the road in an 18-wheeler set up at this museum for 2 or 3 or 4 months, break it down, go to the next place. And, you know, it's been a good ride thus far, and I hope it continues.
Do you do soup to nuts? Once the exhibition has been purchased by the museum, you take it there, you set it up, you break it down when it's time?
Well, that's an interesting and a good question. Some companies, there's a company, a big company in New York City that produces exhibitions, a competitor, and they require that their staff go there and set it up and hang it and design it and lay it out and all of that. I found, though, that the axiom, too many cooks in the kitchen don't end up in a good result. And more often than not, can end up with hard feelings if you're dictatorial and have a heavy hand telling design people or museum curators and the like how to choreograph an exhibition in their museum. They all have tremendous pedigrees of training, you know, master's degrees and PhDs and this, that, and the other thing. And far be it from someone like me or someone that I might work with to go in and tell them how to orchestrate an exhibition in their own space that they know intimately and work inside of day in and day out. So we avoid that. I mean, we give a lot of latitude to the staff to kind of lay it out. And I don't go to every exhibition, but I travel enough. And I often find that if you give them the rein, give them some rope, they make you look better than you are. And it's always new and interesting and a new approach and novel. And, you know, I'm never disappointed in an installation that a museum staff installs of one of our exhibitions. Never. They do great jobs.
You get to see it in a different way.
You do. And it's really fun.
Are there any times when you do say this has to be set up a certain way, but you have latitude for everything else?
No. The only issue might be if there's an installation, for example, where it's complex and you have things hanging from the ceiling, or, you know, there are certain requirements in terms of conservation and protection. I'm working presently with an artist from Japan. Her name is Sayaka Gans, and her exhibition is at the Museum of the Northwest in Spokane. It just went there from a museum in Utah and is having a great run, a great success. And she does these installations where she takes found objects like plastics that she finds floating in the ocean or in a dump, and she assembles them into these incredible, as large as a studio room, incredible installations of a polar bear with her cubs, or an orca, or other school of jellyfish, and she'll light them, and they're hanging by monofilament. In that sense, she created videos for each piece, and we send in advance to the museum the videos, so the staff there can watch her speaking and instructing them how to take it out of the crate, how to hang it, and then to deinstall it and to recreate it. And in that sense, because of the delicacy of the piece, and you want to make sure it's taken care of, and also you don't want something falling on a visitor.
Would not be good.
There's a lot of attention to detail. So that would be an extreme kind of installation that we'd be involved with, but a necessary way to approach it.
So how do you find basing yourself here in Milwaukee? Is it a good central location for the kind of work that you're doing?
It is. I mean, I've lived in and worked in various cities throughout the nation and the world, for that matter. And Milwaukee's been very good. I enjoy Milwaukee, and it's central. But to tell you the truth, I probably could run my business just about anywhere in the world as long as I have an internet connection, because a lot of the work I do is on the computer. You know, first of all, we have a concept that we have to come up with. What would make a good concept for an exhibition? Then you have to flush it out and get the contents to materialize that concept. Then you have to sell it and promote it. Well, that's mass marketing, basically, to museums. Then you have to pull everything together and move it down the road and take it on tour. So that kind of work can be done from an office just about anywhere.
Well, David Wagner, it is so interesting to talk to you, to find out what you do. I assume you have a website that people can go to see what exhibitions are currently happening. Do you have any coming up in Milwaukee other than what's happening in Green Bay?
I don't have any. I'm hopeful there will be some coming here. It would be really nice. We just opened an exhibition that was kind of tangentially related to Milwaukee. There in Daytona Beach, there's something called Bike Week in March, and our exhibition, Luster, which is a hyper-realist painting exhibition of cars and motorcycles, including Harleys and Indian motorcycles and everything else under the sun, was selected to be at the museum to open Bike Week back in March, and that was kind of fun. It would be great to bring it to Milwaukee.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be perfect. I think you need to talk to the Harley folks.
You got that right.
See what you can do. David Wagner, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. I appreciate it.
David Wagner is the founder of the Milwaukee-based David J. Wagner, LLC. The company produces and manages traveling exhibitions for museums and other cultural and scientific institutions throughout the world.
One of those touring exhibitions is currently on view in Green Bay, and it features the work of Canadian explorer, painter, and filmmaker Corey Trepanier. We'll speak with him and David Wagner again when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. There are parts of our planet where most of us will never have the opportunity to travel. But thanks to people like Corey Trepanier, we can still have the opportunity to see them.
Trepanier is an explorer, an artist, and a filmmaker. His traveling exhibition about his Arctic expeditions is currently on display at the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay. It's aptly named Into the Arctic, and the exhibit features Trepanier's oil paintings and several documentaries about his expeditions. He just released the third installment of the films, Into the Arctic, The Last Chapter.
We first spoke with Trepanier in May, along with our previous guest, David Wagner, and Trepanier explained what his work adds to our cultural understanding of the Arctic.
The places are so foreign that so few people will actually sort of encounter them in person. They're landscapes that are foreign, but they're beautiful in such an incredible way. So, I mean, I guess on the surface, they're pretty pictures. I hate to say that, but there's more to it than that, especially now as we look at this region and how it's been changing over the last number of years, the Inuit I've traveled with explaining how their lives have changed as a result of the climate changing there as well, that perhaps more now than ever, there's an opportunity to bring awareness to a landscape undergoing great change. And hopefully, as an artist, what I really aspire to is to help other people fall in love with these places a little. Because maybe then, that's the beginning of it. That's the beginning of people taking care of something as if they actually care about it in the first place. So for most people, it's an introduction. It's bringing it on their radar in the first place. But to know that these are real places, part of our incredible planet that we live on, and hopefully can inspire people to get out and explore more and see for themselves and look at after it.
Your exhibits feature not only paintings, but also these films. What do you think the films add to the paintings and vice versa? What do you think, how do you think these two things play off of one another?
I hope the films add some of the real experience that I had while traveling there. And I became a filmmaker after being an artist, if you will. I mean, it's always been about the art. And I start to realize as an artist, I could not capture everything of this experience on canvas, no matter how many paintings I did. And so I started to bring those experiences that I was having together in my films. And personally, it allowed me to tell so much more of a story, not only the story of where these pieces came from, but the whole larger ecosystem of what it is to actually explore these places. And so similarly, in the terms of the exhibition, the films are a really critical part. People have a chance to see the work actually beginning in the field, and I guess it lends to the authenticity of the art that they're seeing. But hopefully it helps to educate and inspire them with all the other peripheral things outside of the act of painting. As mentioned, the wildlife that I've encountered, polar bears, muskox, the Inuit people who I've traveled with, who have shared their culture with me and helped me to understand the land better, and spending that time one-on-one with them. And hopefully that will also bring an awareness of what it takes to live in the Arctic for these cultures who are having quite a challenge up there and these wonderful people. There's history as well, some that even American history I've encountered in the Canadian Arctic, like this place called Fort Conger, where Adolphus Greely went and explored in 1872 or something. And unfortunately, only 7 of 27 men returned. And it was the worst Arctic exploration disaster in American exploration history. And so there's so many different things that I've encountered as a human being while out painting that I just had to start bringing those things together and sharing stories that hopefully connect people even more.
David, as someone who is on the outside of this, who isn't exploring this, but is very familiar with artwork and in your line of work, how do you curate this material for different audiences? Because I imagine people in North America at least kind of peripherally understand this kind of landscape. They know it's there at least. Is it different when you go to European audiences, or is it really the same?
I think that's the same. When the exhibition premiered at the Embassy of Canada, a requirement of Canadian government is that exhibition labels and text materials be bilingual. And so the exhibition has a text in French and English, and generous text authored by Corey himself to describe and narrate the pictures to enable viewers to really get inside the pictures, the paintings. And that's a helpful tool because, of course, you may stand in front of a painting and appreciate its beauty in terms of composition, design, use of color, and so forth. But in addition to artistic elements and principles of design, Corey's provided an inside track of information to allow people to get inside each particular artwork. And the narrative on the labels is quite informative, interesting, and engaging.
You mentioned about different regions interacting with the work. It's been very interesting for me after a decade of essentially creating this collection in private, up in my barn, north of Toronto in Caledon, to have it go before the public. And after this decade of doing this, and I was wondering myself, how will people respond to the work, and how will they respond to it in different regions? So the exhibition, just about a year ago, went to Tucson, Arizona. I'd never been to Arizona before. It was a great excuse. One of the wonderful things about the tour is I've got to see so much more of our neighbors than I've ever seen before. And so when it went to Arizona in the Sonoran Desert, it was approaching 40 degrees Celsius. And I thought, how are people going to react to these images of the far north, of the very northern end of North America, ice, you know, icebergs, glaciers, and it's not all that. There's also tundra. And what I found was that as I was there talking to visitors coming through, people were extremely engaged. I mean, not only was there a high level of environmental awareness amongst the visitors because of the nature of the particular venue in the museum, but also it's a desert there. It's a completely opposite kind of desert. There's cactus, it's extreme, and places I've gone to in the high Arctic are classified as polar deserts, sand and very little precipitation. So here we have two kinds of deserts, completely opposite, and people found it fascinating to be able to have this unique insight into this part of the world. But I also realized that same feedback I'm getting from pretty well everybody I talked to in Canada. I mean, we had a Canadian premiere in Vancouver, and the north of Canada for most Canadians is probably just as could be the moon, just as much as it was for somebody in Arizona. And so it seems like it's an opportunity for everybody anywhere to connect with this part of the world because it is so unique. And Canadians know it's there, but very few ever get to see it themselves. So
now, this is the third installment, really, of this series, Into the Arctic. And it's the last part of it, or it seems to be the last part of it.
Into the Arctic 3 is the final chapter of my film series, the completion of the trilogy that I started a decade ago alongside all the paintings. So Into the Arctic 3, the last chapter, is this last 90-minute documentary that I've just completed that encompasses my last major expedition, which was almost 9 weeks across the Arctic, in a bid to fulfill a few more canvases to add to the tour, to complete the tour, and also includes some of the story of the actual exhibition going to Washington. And I just returned about a week and a half ago from Monaco, where we had the privilege of showing Into the Arctic 3. I'm losing count, but it is the last one. but we were invited by Prince Albert II Foundation, and we had the opportunity to screen the film for the first time before Prince Albert II and a number of others in Monaco. And so that film is just sort of starting its own life. It will be joining the tour, but we've entered it into major film festivals and everything else. So in the coming months, that film tells, I guess, the completion of the story. Meanwhile, the exhibition itself continues to tour for a couple more years.
So is this footage from earlier explorations? Is this...
It's from my last major expedition. So I initially did 3 expeditions to the Arctic, each range from a month to 2.5 months. And then a couple of years ago, I returned to the Arctic for my 4th expedition. And the footage from that 4th expedition from 2015, along with our filming at the Embassy of Canada, got all woven together to tell the final sort of story of this project that actually began a decade ago. So we reach back with some early footage a little bit here and there as well. So it's really... While the other films are more sort of expedition-based, this one carries a story arc that goes over a decade in length.
Yeah. One of the fascinating things I found in my research of you is you do a lot of these expeditions with your wife, but also your children, starting off when they were very little. What is that experience like, going around with a 5-year-old, a 2-year-old?
Oh, well, it's been amazing. We started to... do my fine art as a career. I was doing commercial art for about 10 years, painting for ad agencies and magazine covers and so on. And I really started to fall in love with the process of taking an easel out and just painting. This was between my commercial projects. And our girls were 2.5 and 5 years old. And it really became important to me to pursue my fine art. And I had fallen in love with a place called Lake Superior. Probably heard of that. It's massive. I went up there for a project for a couple of weeks and got a taste of it and said, you know, I really, really want to pursue my fine art. And the only way to do this seriously is I can't go for a weekend here, a weekend there. And so we devised a project that would allow me to go paint for a month in each season on the coast of Lake Superior in Georgian Bay in Canada. When I started looking at that, I said, I can't leave my kids for a month. Certainly Janet won't leave him for a month. And so he said, okay, this is a family trip. This is what, and part of the motivation for that was actually the opportunity to take our kids out there with us so they can experience these incredible travels and these parts of our planet. And so it became a family journey, and we encountered all kinds of amazing experiences throughout that. So when the Arctic came on my radar, and in 2006, I decided, okay, this is the next big thing I want to do with my career. I want to paint these places that are so alluring. We devised it as a family expedition as well. The girls were then 7 and 11, and we left home and didn't come back for 2.5 months. And the girls were not only part of the expedition, but they were active participants in that. We have a blog section on the website where we said to our girls, Andy was 11, said, look, you know, we're not just dragging you around here. We want you to experience this and then try to put back into words to share it with other people, because not many kids your age will ever get a chance to do this. And they took it to heart, and she wrote like 25 little stories, and we did little video journals with them and all that. And so it was really an incredible family experience. They sensed for the first time in their life isolation from family and friends. We were out in the remote landscape in the tent, fog all around us for miles. So it was really, as a family unit, an incredible experience to bind us together further. And although we were not able to really take them on some of the subsequent Arctic expeditions due to logistics and due to, well, concern over safety as well, hanging out in polar bear country with shotgun in your tent at night and that kind of stuff, I was really glad the kids weren't there. I'm thrilled that this summer our youngest, who was 7, who's now 19, will be joining me back in the Arctic for a two-week hike over 100 kilometers on Baffin Island through these glaciers and kilometer-high granite walls. And so, yeah, we have a little return visit coming up, which I'm thrilled about.
Do you plan to film that?
Well, actually, you know, I initially thought about it. And every time I've gone to the Arctic, it's been with camera in tow with the intention of creating a film. And I decided, you know, I just finished Into the Arctic 3. It was a huge endeavor. I've got a new film coming out all this year, A. And B, the opportunity to have 2 weeks with my 19-year-old, I may never get this opportunity again, and I don't want the distraction of filming it seriously. Now, of course, we're still going to bring a camera with us. And actually, Sydney's interested in doing blogs herself, and we'll be doing some stuff for the web, but not to create a film per se. Hopefully so, create a lot of personal memories, too.
A little bit of a break.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me about your work, and thanks for visiting Milwaukee.
Wow, it's been a thrill. We came over on the big lake ferry, Express. It felt like the Arctic weather. It was like freezing up on there, but it was so beautiful to come across. And our first visit ever, we've been given a fantastic tour with Dave and love it.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joy.
Corey Trepanier is an artist and filmmaker, and David Wagner is the producer and manager of Trepanier's traveling exhibit, which is named Into the Arctic. We first spoke with them in May.
The exhibition features Trepanier's oil paintings and documentaries of his expeditions, including his most recent and final addition to the show, Into the Arctic 3, The Last Chapter. His work will be on display at the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay through mid-August.
Well, the weather is perfect for having a meal outside. Coming up next, we'll talk with Milwaukee Magazine's dining critic Ann Christensen about some of her favorite places to dine al fresco. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR right after this. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. There's a lot to recommend during a Milwaukee summer. The festival season, Lake Michigan beaches, and even the Brewers this season. But if you're making a list of things that make the summertime special, you may include outdoor dining.
And where that once would have meant a simple sidewalk cafe, restaurants around the Milwaukee area are putting their own unique stamp on dining al fresco. In the latest edition of Milwaukee Magazine, dining critic and Lake Effect contributor Ann Christensen writes about three noteworthy outdoor dining experiences around our city. She joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke to expand on that list a little bit and to explain why alfresco meals appeal to us so much.
My theory about why outdoor dining has really gotten even better here in terms of where you can sit on rooftops with these incredible gardens, you know, green roofs, things like that, is that we have such a short amount of time to really enjoy it. So this is, you know, this is that precious time that we can get up there, out there, and enjoy outdoor dining.
Well, and something you just mentioned is it's also creative use of
yes.
outdoor dining. There's imagination being brought to bear. It's mm-hmm. not, these are not just tables that are scattered around a sidewalk in front of a restaurant, although there are plenty of those restaurants mm-hmm. that are still out there as well.
Right. And, you know, there's so many places that have good patios. I'm not going to say that we're limited to three places, but I was given the, you know, the directive to come up with three really great ones this year for this particular issue that I was working on, tough challenge. So I thought, well, you know, let me think about this a little bit differently. Maybe highlight some places we haven't mentioned for a while and that maybe have some unique attributes, you know, to those patios, right? So that's
start.
What I did. Yeah.
Let's start with one in Brookfield. This is Parkside 23.
Parkside 23.
I know nothing about.
Yeah. Okay, so this is a restaurant that's probably been open, 6-7 years, something like this. It is out on
Pilgrim Parkway, right?
Parkway and North Avenue.
Of where this is,
yes.
But yes.
And it's like it looks like a house. Mm-hmm. And it's adjacent to a farm. They have their own sort of on-site farm. So not only do you have this patio, which is kind of like a terrace for them with, you know, umbrella top tables, and there's lots of flowers and shrubs. So it feels intimate and quiet. You get a summer menu that where ingredients are culled from the farm right next door.
This is not just a casual use of the term farm to table.
Exactly. Right. And not only so you could go and, you know, sit on the patio and enjoy a meal there. They also are doing farm dinners this summer, that so you can actually get a tour of the farm and eat outside. They have tables set up. So there's an actual whole program that they do to kind of highlight that.
How cool.
Their farm. Yeah.
All right. So Parkside 23 in Brookfield. Another one is fairly well known to, I think, a lot of public radio listeners to this program, and that is Braise.
Yeah, but I think, you know, some people don't realize that Braise has a rooftop patio.
I did not.
Right. I mean, we all think of Benelux. We think of the Outsider at the Kimpton, which great patios, and they're big spaces. Braise has a small patio on its roof, maybe 8 to 10 tables up there. And it allows people to go up and actually see what they're growing on the roof, because they're growing herbs.
It says roof to table.
They're doing beekeeping up there. So that's a really charming little space, you know, little white lights, so it's kind of glowing at night. In the distance, you can see the Hone Bridge and the sun setting and all of this. So, you know, it's a very intimate space if you want to go with maybe one other person, quiet. And again, they have a really, their whole thing is farm to table too. So a lot of summer ingredients you're going to start seeing on their menu as well.
If you're going to be eating outdoors, you might as well have the sense that the food came from outdoors as well.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, as a lot of chefs are saying these days, eat seasonal. That's the best way to eat. So, yeah.
So you've done a really nice job of taking three restaurants that are very diverse because, as we said, it's a challenge when you're only choosing three. We should mention La Merenda.
Yeah, La Merenda, when it opened, it was probably the first place in town that was really doing small plates. It kind of introduced us to that idea of what tapas could be.
Right.
So their whole menu is international cuisine, so tapas from all over the world. And several years into their run, they decided to open a patio. And it's not just a little patio. It's a pretty big endeavor, you know. So it offers dining that's kind of covered or uncovered if you like sun. It has a lounge area in front of a fireplace. They're also really into cocktails there. They make their own sodas. So they do, yes, and that might be interesting to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
They do cocktails that utilize some of those sodas that they make.
Sure.
And they make special flavors in the summertime. And they're also just, you know, doing mocktails too with these sodas. So that's a really fun way to, like, I think, rev up your summer cocktail menu too. And also know that you don't have to drink alcohol to get a really nice beverage.
Right.
You know, you can get something really refreshing and delicious.
Right. You can be creative
without
the alcohol.
It doesn't dehydrate
right.
you. Yeah, without the alcohol.
All right, so those are the three that you mentioned in the article. Do you have any others that are your go-to places you just want to go out and enjoy a meal or a snack someplace outdoors?
Yeah, I love like kind of little hidden patios. There's a place called Camino, which is just a bar right on 2nd Street. They have kind of a little patio that's like in between the buildings. But it's sort of cool and set away from the street, so it feels kind of intimate and mysterious. You don't necessarily know that it's there unless you go in there, and that's kind of fun because they have pierogies and they have sausages and they have this great kimchi sandwich. So that's a fun little place. I do like the Pizza Man on Downer because they also have a rooftop.
Right.
You can sit out on. You can actually be in that area that's sort of covered, but then there's a little area that's sort of over the sidewalk that you can just see this, you know, this great little view of Downer Avenue. I love the patio at Cafe Corazon in River West. It's a very unique building anyway because it's an odd-shaped building, let's put it that way. And they have this really sweet patio that's kind of on this grassy area, sort of near the bike path. And you just, you know, it just feels really quiet and kind of not loud, but you're out there. It's kind of urban, but not really. That's a really great patio too. There's so many though, Mitch.
That is a throwback to a phenomenon I remembered when, this is 2002, and we were in Sweden and eating outside, and just the fact that you could be in a busy city.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an evening. It was probably like a Thursday evening or something. It was busy without being loud, which is something that you don't often experience in this country. You know, like in the middle of a city, but there are no sounds of jackhammers. The trucks aren't downshifting right in front of you. You can be in a place where there is a certain sense of vital energy, but it's not a loud sense.
Yeah, exactly. I also find that, you know, even if tables are placed somewhat close to one another on a patio, since it's open air, it feels less like you're kind of crushed together with all these other people. To me, sitting outside is the best part about summer. I mean, another place, if you like to get a beer and just, you know, like a sandwich or something like that, is Stubby's. They have a great patio that's right on the river, and it's just off of Humboldt, just north of downtown. Again, just absolutely pristine little space, and really quiet and beautiful, and a wonderful space to watch the sun go down. And to me, you know, watching a sunset from a patio is one of the best parts about it.
What a great bunch of suggestions, Anne. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anne Christensen is senior editor and dining critic at Milwaukee Magazine and a Lake Effect contributor. Her article on outdoor dining is in the July issue of the magazine, and she spoke with Mitch Tyke.
From outdoor dining to outdoor theater, when Lake Effect returns, we'll talk with the founder of the theater company that brings Shakespeare to the state parks, and we'll find out what the state parks get in the bargain. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. The concept of Shakespeare in the Park is nothing new. Many of Shakespeare's plays are just as at home in the out-of-doors as they are on a stage within a theater. Well, the Summit Players Theater is no longer new either. The company has performed Shakespeare for audiences at Wisconsin State Parks for the past 4 summers.
Summit's founder Hannah Klapperich-Mueller has spoken about what the company gets from performing in spaces that normally are home to wildlife and campers. But we haven't heard from the other side of the equation. Why do the parks themselves extend a welcome to the performances each year?
So Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke ventured to Haven Woods State Forest on Milwaukee's north side, where the Summit Players will perform in August. He met up with Klapperich-Mueller, along with conservation biologist Beth
Mittermeier. We are thrilled to have you here.
Yes, it's always very exciting when you can join us in the park to see where we're doing a performance.
Well, and as I was saying as we were walking over, I'm ashamed to say that this is the first time I have set foot in Haven Woods State Forest. And I have to say, this is a revelation. We are just a hop, skip, and a jump off of some really busy roads, and this is anything but busy feeling.
This is one of our favorite places to perform, just because it's fun to have friends and family from Milwaukee come and then be kind of immersed in this natural setting while we're doing our performance. And it just has a really magical feeling, this little grove with, where there are a lot of trees around us, and then there are seats. And once we get our picnic table and our banner set up, it really becomes this like beautiful backdrop for a cozy little performance.
And as I recall from our previous interviews, there are not always built-in seats where you perform.
Correct. So often we perform just in a grassy field or along a lake or somewhere where there is an open space. But we're lucky at Haven Woods that there is this existing amphitheater. And that always does kind of kick it up a notch. It just adds sort of to the magic of the performance.
We are, I don't know, 100 yards from the main parking lot at Haven Woods, and yet this really is magical. Paint a picture of where we're standing.
So there's a large maple tree to one side of the stage, and there are three sort of tiers of seats going back, and then the whole amphitheater is surrounded by just some low shrubbery, and the birds are singing, and the sunlight just kind of like filters through the leaves and makes this sort of like very fairyland, woodland-esque setting.
Just the right place for 12th night?
Well, so yes, 12th night is a little bit different. Similar to last year, this performance takes place primarily in homes or in the court of Elyria. But there are some scenes that take place in a garden, so that will be perfect for when we are here. Sir Toby and his cohorts, the kind of like fun-loving tomfoolery people in the play, they spend a lot of time getting up to hijinks in the garden and playing tricks on Malvolio.
And as I recall, there is a lot of, at least as the Summit players do it, a lot of costume changing, a lot of doubling up on things.
Exactly. So we have six actors playing all of the characters, and I'm not actually sure of the count of how many characters we have this year, but I know that two of our actors are playing at least six. So they have a lot of costume changes, and some of them are almost instantaneous. They come out as one character, they drop off whoever they've escorted on stage, and then they run back behind the banner and come out as someone else for their line. So it is very quick, it's very fast-paced, and it's very funny.
Well, so you have this track record of doing this. How many parks have you performed in since this began? This is what, the third season?
This is our fourth season,
right.
Actually, yes. And so we're doing 17 this year, and this will be the highest number. So we've performed in 16 different state parks so far, and we're trying out a couple of new ones this year. So Haven Woods we have been loyal to and will continue to remain loyal to because we love it so much, but a couple of our new shows are at Wildcat Mountain State Park and Copper Culture State Park and then Interstate State Park up north of Minneapolis.
Do you remember as you were beginning this troupe 4 years ago, 4+ years ago, mm-hmm. how you approached the parks to pitch this idea? I mean, Shakespeare in the Park is nothing new, but Shakespeare in the State Parks is relatively new.
So we pitched it as an idea that we wanted to do in collaboration with the Department of Natural Resources so that we could bring this same performance and program and workshop to a bunch of different places around the state. So our mission as a company is to bring theater to places in the state where there might not be much or to make it accessible to people regardless of where they live or how much their income is. So we want to bring this free program and make Shakespeare something that you think of as fun and exciting and playful rather than something boring that you read in your high school English class.
You're performing here inside this grove of trees. There's a canopy above us, which makes it, first of all, delightfully cool, considering, I mean, it's probably in the mid-70s as we're recording this, but how does the lighting work the night that you're performing here? Because I would imagine it gets pretty dark in here.
So that is a challenge that we've kind of been learning how to deal with each season, particularly because our season has happened at different points in the summer. So shows that we have in June and early July, we have light all the way until the end of the show. But as we get further on into the summer, we need to start making adjustments and making sure that characters are bringing out different lighting instruments. And 12th Night, which we're performing this year, we are setting it in an Elizabethan setting. So everybody's wearing traditional costumes. You'll see people in ruffs. You'll see people in tights under their jeans and their Converse, of course, or staples. But we're going to have to figure out what kind of sort of period lighting we can add to the show and just make it sort of seamlessly appear in all of these really quick costume changes.
Right. The performance here is on August 10th, and mm-hmm. by then the days will have been getting shorter for a while.
Yep. So we're just going to have to figure out how we can hide a flashlight and make it look like a torch or something and make sure that each different performance location is getting their needs met because they're all so different.
Beth, I would be remiss if I didn't ask whether there are other things that are coming up at Haven Woods between now and the 12th night performance that people ought to be aware of.
We have, on the first Saturday of every month, we have family hikes. And the one coming up, I think, is Cooking with Fire. We have programs on Saturday mornings, story times for kids. But most of our programming is with youth groups, daycare centers, schools, summer schools. And they can call anytime and register to come for a program.
In addition to Shakespearean actors, what sort of wildlife would one encounter in Haven Woods?
Depends on what time of day you come and how quiet you are and how much you're willing to venture off the path, the beaten path. We have all of the typical urban animals, coyotes, raccoons, opossums, skunks, lots of birds.
Snakes and turtles.
And snakes and turtles, yes. Four different kinds of snakes live here.
Well, and that dovetails with the question I was going to ask you. You have typical audience members. Have you ever been visited by interesting wildlife during a performance at a state park?
Just mosquitoes.
Oh my gosh, so many mosquitoes. I'm not sure that we've ever had a visitor during a performance, but a fun fact about the Summit Players is that we often camp in the parks where we are performing. So we have had raccoons come and visit our campsite and fight outside our tent. We made friends with a small painted turtle this past Sunday on our way back from High Cliff State Park, and we helped him get off the road onto the side of the road that he was heading towards.
So a nice symbiotic relationship.
Yes.
Well, listen, Hannah and Beth, thank you both so much for sharing both the story of Haven Woods and Summit Players' 12th night performance this summer and break an Elizabethan leg.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming. I'm glad you finally got here.
Me too.
Hannah Klapperich-Mueller is founder of Summit Players Theater, which is now in its fourth season of presenting Shakespeare in state parks around Wisconsin.
Beth Mittermeier is a conservation biologist at Haven Woods State Forest in Milwaukee, where Summit Players Theater will perform 12th night on August 10th. They spoke with Mitch Teich, and you can find a full schedule of their shows at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air comes your way next. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.